Fate and Other Variables. An angry drug dealer was waving a gun in my face, and it was all Greg's fault. I raised my hands, palms up, very slowly. Whatever he did this time, I'm sure we can work it out.
Sure we can,
said the man my brother called Coins. He invaded my personal space, his face uncomfortably close to mine, the stink of tobacco heavy on his breath.
Pay me the 3 large this weasel owes me, and I'll be on my way.
I turned to Greg, mostly to disengage from the unsavory character in front of me. Greg looked at me with that same guilty expression on his face I'd seen so many times while growing up. I screwed up again, his expression was saying. But it's all right, because Big Brother Mike is going to make everything better, fix things like he always does. It was the look I'd seen whenever our parents found pot hidden in his room. The same look he'd given me whenever I came to bail him out of jail, or whenever he would show up on my doorstep in the middle of the night asking for cash. Some things never change. I don't keep that kind of money on hand.
Well then, we'll just have to see what you do have.
The man went through the house looking for valuables. Greg and I followed but gave him plenty of space. My heart raced like an overclocked CPU, then skipped a beat when he found my office. An L-shaped workbench stood at the center of the room. 3 large monitors were lined up on top of it. A wireless keyboard and mouse rested upon piles of printouts and handwritten notes, and all along 4 walls of the room, stacked up to the ceiling on metal shelving units, were dozens of networked computers.
What are you? Some kind of hacker?
Computers are logical and predictable. They don't make irrational choices, and they never let you down unless you mess up the code. Growing up around Greg, it's no wonder I liked them better than people. I understood them better, too. So yes, I was a hacker, and a damn good one, too. But it wouldn't do to advertise the fact to 2-bit criminals.
I'm an IT consultant.
The man with the gun smiled.
I bet these'll fetch a few bucks.
Listen, pal, I'll get you your money. I'll pay Greg's debt in full so long as you promise to cut him off. But I can't have you messing with my equipment. He grabbed fistfuls of my t-shirt.
Don't you ever threaten me, nerd,
he hissed, spittle flying from his mouth. Excuse me, sounded the voice from the door. Another stranger stood in the doorway. He was an older man with a thick, graying beard. He wore a black wool coat and held a wide-brimmed hat in his hand, his head covered with a small skull cap.
You are done here, he told Coins, his voice calm and facial expression a picture of serenity.
Get out. Coins let go of me and advanced on the older man, the pistol aimed squarely at his belly. The stranger pointed at the gun, and it began to melt. What had once been a pistol lost its form, and the resulting goo slid down the drug dealer's fingers like ice cream from a cone that was left out in the sun. His eyes went wide as he tried to shake off the viscous substance. Some of it clung to his hand, like gunmetal-colored honey.
Leave, the old man repeated, before I do the same to you.
The drug dealer's lip trembled as he stared at what used to be his weapon. He gave me an evil look, a promise of future retaliation strongly implied, but he didn't push his luck. He shuffled out the door, subdued.
I couldn't blame him. A large part of me wanted to flee as well, my rational brain struggling to accept whatever had just occurred. Greg looked more miserable than ever, but he stayed also, hovering in the farthest corner of the room.
I heard the front door slam. The stranger just stood there, studying me closely. I opened my mouth to speak, but after a long moment closed it again.
I believe thank you are the words you are looking for, he said, a hint of smile hidden in his beard.
"Who are you?" I asked instead.
"My name is Nathan Adler," he said. "I'm a Kabbalist." I'd vaguely heard of Kabbalah before. It was an obscure form of mysticism, and as such, mattered little to my scientific worldview.
"Is that how you did that?" Greg spoke up.
I was a little surprised that he recognized the term. "Yes," said Adler matter-of-factly, without a hint of pride or boasting. "You and I have a lot to talk about, Michael," he added. "I find myself in need of your skill set."
"No offense, but I don't believe any of this. Whatever you did to melt that guy's gun was a very neat trick, but the rest of it is way over the top. And even if it were real, how does one hack a metaphysical book?"
We were sitting in my living room, Greg banished elsewhere in the house. Adler was telling me stuff that sounded like it came straight out of a fantasy novel.
"You must understand," he said, "that Kabbalah is, at its heart, an exact science. Talmudic scholars used a lot of metaphors to describe things the modern scholars are only now beginning to explore at the most sophisticated levels of theoretical physics. The Almighty designed the universe to operate under strict logical rules, like a computer program. Think of Kabbalah as a developer toolkit that can modify small subroutines within that program."
"All right," I said. "Let's say for the moment that you're right, and shelve the argument as to whether the universe has an intelligent designer of any kind."
I shifted in the armchair. "You're saying there is this book of fate, and that angels spend 1 week every year writing down the destiny of every human being in the world, and that whatever they write down is locked in for the next year? Did I get that right? And if so, how is this even remotely related to science?"
"Again, much of that is metaphor. Many of the ancient cultures were aware of this phenomenon and explained it using whatever imagery their contemporaries could understand." Adler laid things out patiently, like a parent explaining to his kid that there's no such thing as Santa Claus. "Except this was pretty much the exact opposite of that. The important thing for us is that there's a record. Think of it as a database of people's fates, determined a year in advance. And there's a 10-day-long window during which this record can be altered." I felt like a film crew for one of those gotcha reality shows should burst from the bedroom at any moment. Still, I'd seen him do the impossible with my own eyes. Also, he'd extricated Greg and me from a very hairy situation. Least I could do was entertain his theories.
"What about free will? I seem to recall that being an important tenet of Judeo-Christian philosophy."
"Free will isn't limitless," said Adler. "For example, you can't fly out the window, no matter how much you may want to. Free will manifests in dozens of smaller decisions you make every day. Those choices won't alter what's written in the Book of Fate, though many believe that they have a direct effect on what is to be written down for next year."
"And you want us to get in there and rewrite your future so that you can become what, a king of the world?"
"Nothing like that," Adler said. "We'll introduce small changes that should fly under the radar, lest they're discovered and corrected. For instance, you could alter your brother's life trajectory by eliminating his drug addiction." Adler said this almost casually, but the bastard knew exactly which buttons to push, knew that the possibility alone would force me to consider his proposal, even while it still sounded more than a little crazy.
"Why me?" I asked. "Why not some hacker or hardware whiz who already buys into all this stuff?"
"Because you're both a hacker and a hardware whiz. You're the best there is," Adler said. I checked. Also, as an atheist, you shouldn't have as much difficulty with the philosophical implications of my plan. Which begged another question. What about him? I asked, pointing upward. How can you, as a religious man, justify going against the wishes of the guy upstairs?
For the first time since we met, Adler didn't have a smooth, ready-made answer. He sat on my couch, silent, but his mind was somewhere else entirely. Finally, he spoke so quietly that I barely understood the words. I have my reasons. I let the matter drop. I slammed the dusty old volume shut and tossed it onto the table in frustration. I need a break, I said, rubbing my temples.
Careful, Adler said, a bit louder than usual. After a few months of working together, I'd learned to decipher the subtle hints of emotion hidden behind the man's calm facade. I was fairly sure that I detected a tiniest bit of annoyance in his voice.
Sorry, he added.
We are taught to revere books in my culture.
My bad.
I got up to stretch and massage the back of my neck. A glance at the wall clock confirmed what my weary body already knew. We'd been at it for most of the day. When I'd signed on to Adler's mad scheme, the first order of business had been for me to learn the bastardized version of Hebrew the Kabbalists used as their programming language. Each of the 22 hieroglyphs was a letter, but it was also a concept and a number, and contained far more meaning than anyone should expect from a single character. Learning to comprehend this stuff was slow going, to say the least. And while I was learning it, however slowly, I made no progress at all deciphering Adler himself. I researched the man online the minute he left my house on the day we met. There was a famous Kabbalist named Nathan Adler in Europe a few hundred years ago, and a number of our contemporaries shared that name. But my new acquaintance wasn't among them. He used an alias, which meant that he had something to hide, such as, perhaps, the alterations he intended to make to this book of fate. After a short break, we delved back into the study session, only to be interrupted by the chime of a cell phone. Adler fished the device from the inner pocket of his jacket. I perked up. In all the time we'd spent together, his phone had never rung before. Adler picked up and listened intently to whomever was at the other end of the line, his jaw clenched. At times he replied in brief bursts of Yiddish, his voice monotone as ever. The conversation lasted less than a minute.
"Something's come up. I have to go," Adler said once he'd hung up the phone. "We'll pick this up again tomorrow."
Adler departed in a hurry. I was left sitting in the empty house. Greg was out, working his shift at the part-time job he'd found, stocking the produce section at a local supermarket. Greg had managed to stay off drugs and out of trouble since our close encounter with Coins, and was genuinely trying to put his life back on track. So I sat in the living room alone, trying to figure out what Adler was up to. On impulse, I ran outside and dragged my Honda CBR out of the garage. I got on the bike and sped down the street, hoping to catch Adler before he reached the highway. Adler drove a 20-year-old Buick Estate Roadmaster, a station wagon with stripes of simulated wood grain on the sides. There aren't many of those on the road, which made Adler a lot easier to follow while keeping my distance. It also helped that the tinted shield of my bike helmet completely obscured my face. Adler got onto Route 9 and took it all the way north to Outer Bridge Crossing, across Staten Island and into Brooklyn. He parked in front of the Maimonides Hospital and rushed inside. At the front desk, Adler had to sign in. I watched him go up the elevator before I walked up, and with a friendly nod to the guard, signed in as a visitor myself, and scanned the previous entry for the name and room number. Breaking into the hospital network was a breeze,
once I found a courtesy internet terminal in one of the waiting areas. I learned that the sole occupant of the room in question was Mrs. Sheila Horowitz, 64 years of age and recuperating from surgery. Sheila's prognosis wasn't good. Stage 4 pancreatic cancer. A malignant tumor had grown on her liver, unnoticed until it was too late. Doctors had removed the primary tumor in surgery, but it had already metastasized. She likely had between 6 months and a year to live. And that's assuming she recovered from the invasive surgery. It was still touch and go for the moment. Adler, or was it Horowitz, was beginning to make sense to me now. He wasn't out to cheat the universe of its plan for some sort of personal gain. He was trying to save his wife. There aren't a lot of things in life powerful enough to cause a man of faith to go against what he saw as the wishes of his creator. But love certainly qualifies. I sympathized with their plight, and was ashamed, because in some conflicted way I was comforted by the knowledge of it. This meant Adler's reasons and motivations were only human, after all. Adler and I spent the summer working feverishly to prepare ourselves. According to the Kabbalist, the window of opportunity to alter the Book of Fate was coming up in late September. The next year's fortunes would be written down between the Jewish holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Adler couldn't wait another year. And now that I'd figured out his reason, I understood why. Frankly, I couldn't take another year of preparations myself. As difficult as it was to learn the language, that was child's play compared to mastering Kabbalah's practical applications and building the hardware. Greg seemed content working his menial job, watching sports on TV, and chasing after women. He was doing well in that last department, if any of his constant bragging was to be believed. He never brought anyone over to the house, but he stayed out overnight at least once a week. Greg's wasn't a life I would find fulfilling, but he appeared to be happy, and that was good enough for me. So when he didn't come home one morning, I wasn't worried. But he didn't show up the next day either, and didn't return my phone calls. By then, I became concerned enough to go look for him at work. I spotted Jose, Greg's co-worker and buddy, stocking shelves in one of the aisles. I walked over. "Hey, is Greg around?" Jose wiped the sweat off his forehead with a sleeve. "Nah, man. I haven't seen him in a while. Not since he got canned."
"What?
When was this?" Jose gave me a surprised look. "You mean you don't know? It was just over a week ago. One of the supervisors walked in on him shooting up heroin in the stockroom."
Shit.
Greg was using again. And like any resourceful junkie, he was hiding it pretty damn well. I'd tried everything I could think of to help my little brother, from dragging him to AA meetings to paying for fancy detox clinics. There was literally nothing I wouldn't do to help him get clean. But I couldn't spend my life watching over his every move. He was an adult now, and he always found a way to screw up. Jose patted my shoulder. "Sorry you had to hear it from me, man. Greg's a decent sort. I hope he works everything out. Tell him the guys at work are wishing him all the best. We didn't get a chance to say goodbye the way the management booted him that day. At least they didn't call the cops on him, so that's something." I thanked Jose and headed out. I rode around town checking some of Greg's favorite haunts, but there was no sign of him. His phone must have been off. The calls went straight to voicemail. By the time I exhausted my options and returned home, it was a little past noon. "Where have you been?" Adler said to me in lieu of a greeting. "We have less than a month left and you're wasting half a day on who knows what." I told him. "I'm so sorry, Michael," Adler said. "Addiction is a powerful thing. It's all too easy to relapse. Things will be much better for him once we succeed.
If we succeed. And even then, that was a month away. Greg needed help now.
I've a better idea, I said. Why don't you fix him? Melt away his cravings like you did that gun.
I would if I could, Adler frowned.
If you're concerned over my motivation, then I assure you...
Adler cut me off. You should have a better understanding of Kabbala by now than to expect this of me. It's not some fairy tale magic. I can't wave a wand and change the man's soul. There's only one method that I know of to cheat fate, and we're already working on that.
I growled in frustration and punched the wall hard enough to leave a small indentation in the sheetrock.
Was Adler truly powerless to help Greg? Or was he holding back in order to keep the stakes high for me, keep me focused on his scheme? Ultimately, it didn't matter. Unlike any kind of a higher power, I had no influence or control over Greg's destiny. And the best way to help him was for Adler's plan to succeed. I rubbed my sore knuckles and sat down to work. The machine we built was a thing of beauty. Well, not exactly. It was a jumbled mess of wires and microchips, fused with equal parts solder and magic. A do-it-yourself project if there ever was one. It was a labor of love and countless hours of hard work. And to me, that made it beautiful. Adler and I jury-rigged a spellcasting interface. I could input and store the complex symbols of power, and the computer would convert them into the metaphysical programming language of the universe. The Buddhists had the right idea with automated prayer wheels powered by water and wind. This was taking the same concept to another level. Cutting-edge processors would fire off incantations exponentially faster than a human being ever could. If any man-made device could pick the locks on heaven's door, this was it. We finished it with a couple of days to spare. We did as much theoretical testing as we could, and the results were promising. Until the 10-day-long window Adler referred to as the Days of Awe opened, all we could do was wait. I was decompressing and enjoying some much-needed time apart from Adler when my cell rang and Greg's name popped up on caller ID. This was the first time Greg had bothered to touch base since he disappeared nearly a month ago. I worried about him constantly, even though this wasn't the first time Greg had gone AWOL. Hello? I picked up the phone with a mixture of relief and indignation. Hello, Michael. I did not recognize the voice on the other end of the line. Who is this? Where's Greg?
Gregory sends his regards. He would very much like for you and I to meet. There was a hint of an accent I couldn't quite place. Please join me at the coffee shop, on the corner of Main and Tyson.
Put Greg on the phone.
Coffee shop. 15 minutes. The line went dead, and no one picked up when I called back. 10 minutes later, I was at the cafe, nervously shuffling my phone from one hand to the other, and studying the other patrons from the corner table. I knew the place well. It was only a few blocks from my house, and I frequented it in the mornings. I wondered if the caller had known that. A tall, bearded man in his 40s approached my table with a foam cup in each hand. Medium French vanilla, light and sweet. He set the cup containing my usual order on the table in front of me.
Where's Greg?
My associates have him, the man said cordially, as if he were discussing a piece of furniture. He's safe and secure. Relatively speaking, of course. I still couldn't place the man's accent. His skin tone and facial features hinted at Middle Eastern or Persian ancestry. My first instinct was to lash out at him verbally, demanding answers. Instead, I remained silent,
I didn't want to give him the satisfaction. "You've made quite an impression on the local criminal element," the man continued in the same conversational tone. "A man who calls himself Coins had some fascinating stories to tell about an encounter at your residence. Stories that ultimately reached the ears of my associates and piqued our interest." The man sat down across the table from me and sipped his drink. "Coins was surprisingly subtle and creative in his revenge scheme against you. He tracked down your brother and reintroduced him to the world of narcotics. As I understand it, the first dose was administered under duress. After that, Gregory's inner demons took care of the rest." He took another sip. "In no time at all, your brother was willing to share with us every little detail he knew about your plan. In exchange, we had Coins supply him with whatever pills and powders he desired." Before I knew it, I was on my feet, leaning across the small wooden table, my jaw tightened and my fists clenched. The bastard didn't even flinch. "Easy," he said, as I struggled to control my temper, to stop myself from lunging at him. "Let's not forget that we still have Gregory. You'll have to play nice if you want him back." I stood there for a long moment, awash in the smell of roasted coffee and the sounds of the early afternoon crowd. Ordinary people were going about their everyday lives, unaware of the terrible cruelty of this stranger's soft-spoken words. He had my brother. Taking a swing at him wasn't going to change that. The fight left me, and I slid back into the seat. "Who are you, and what do you want?" I said through my teeth. "My name is Ajit Singh," he replied. "And I'm a mystic, just like the one who calls himself Nathan Adler. I'm no admirer of the man, but I must give credit where it's due. His ideas daring and ingenious, visionary even. In fact, my associates and I like it so much we're going to annex it." He produced a sheet of paper with names and notes handwritten neatly in tiny block letters. "If your machine succeeds at effecting what's etched onto the Pillar of Destinies, we want you to make the following changes, and nothing else. You may aid your brother, and even help yourself to a modest amount of fame or fortune, but you are not to enact any of the alterations Adler asks of you. Understand?" "The man's wife is dying of cancer," I said. "All he wants is to save her." "Is that what he led you to believe?" Singh laughed in my face. "Adler hasn't been married for over 200 years. Adler and I scheduled our attempt for the day before Yom Kippur, the Day of Judgment. As I mulled over what Singh had told me, I read up on the subjects of destiny and kismet. I found references to a preordained recording of future events in almost every ancient faith. An obscure splinter group of Singh's people, the Sikhs, believed that Guru Nanak etched what's to come in marble upon a pillar that rose to the heavens. The Islamic concept of taqdir spoke of the preserved tablet, adjusted annually by Allah based on one's deeds and performed rituals. Other traditions were bursting with stories of people's futures recorded by deities, or spirit guides, or blind scribes. But none of it held the answers I sought. Singh demanded that I say nothing to Adler. I needed the Kabbalist's help in the final preparations for the ritual, which forced Singh's people to keep their distance. Even as we made painstaking preparations, I agonized over what to do. I still hadn't made up my mind by the time we were ready to begin. With a heavy heart, I launched the incantation program. The spellcasting machine whirred to life, lines of code and lines of arcane symbols scrolling down my monitor screens. I worked feverishly, activating various scripts and making on-the-fly adjustments. For a time, I was able to push everything but the pure challenge of the code out of my mind. Even in a strange situation like this one,
I felt in my own element. Computers and codes are logical, predictable. They aren't swayed by emotion, by desire, by addiction. I always knew where I stood with code, because I was capable of understanding its nature. One by one, the layers of arcane protections fell aside like so many network firewalls. My scripts tore relentlessly through the veil of the physical universe. Then the last of the protections gave in and I had full access. Interpreted by my computer, I could see spread before me the fate of every living being in the cosmos. "We did it," I shouted. "We are in."
"I knew you could do it, my friend," Adler said. "Make these modifications quickly now, before our meddling is noticed."
And he handed me a list of his own. There were a dozen names on the page. People I didn't know. Faceless individuals whose future Adler wanted altered and whose fate was now literally in my hands. I scanned through the list. Sheila Horowitz wasn't on it. Adler hadn't lied to me, not exactly. He must have let me follow him that time, so that I'd draw my own conclusions. Still, he was a devious and underhanded man, just like Singh said. Then again, he didn't kidnap my brother and hold him hostage to secure my cooperation. I tried to decide between the two lists as precious moments ticked away. Adler or Singh? The man who'd obtained my help by cunning? Or the man who'd done so by the unsubtle threat of force? Whose vision of the future did I dare unleash upon the world? In the background, Adler was saying something, urging me on. I ignored him. Whatever supernatural forces controlled our lives, our fates, this decision was mine to make alone. Free will, my will, truly mattered in that one moment, perhaps the most important moment of my existence. So I used the hard-won access to do the only thing that made sense to me. I crashed the system. Billions of records, a multitude of preordained paths, were permanently erased. I had no way to know if God or angels, or whatever passed for an intelligent designer in this universe, would eventually rebuild the fate database. I hoped not. There was very little time before Adler would realize what I'd done. I used it to get rid of the scripts and programs I wrote. I had no way of knowing what Adler would do once he found out. Would I survive his reaction? Would Singh release my brother or kill him out of spite? I'd taken a terrible risk to do the right thing, and I could only hope for the best, knowing that whatever happened, the future was in flux, no longer predetermined by anyone. If he survived, my brother would find the inner strength to overcome his addiction, or he would not. Sheila's cancer would go into remission, or it would not. Adler and Singh and billions of others would make everyday decisions, struggle and scheme, win and lose, and do all of it on their own. They truly had free will now. And as I reformatted the spellcasting machine's hard drive so that no one could ever use it again, I took a small comfort in the hope that my decision was the last choice ever forced upon humanity by somebody else. Author's Notes. This story originally appeared in Galaxy's Edge magazine. This is one of my all-time favorite stories I've written. In fact, I pushed back the release date of this book to make sure the exclusive rights would run their course, and I'd be able to include it. In the Hebrew alphabet, each letter is also a number. The practitioners of Kabbalah study the Torah through the prism of these numbers, looking to glimpse some additional insights into the meaning of its passages. And, since anything that can be converted to numbers might also be calculated faster and more efficiently by computers, a spell-casting interface seemed like the natural next step.